Welcome to Our Interesting Times with host Timothy Kelly, who interviews today's top alternative and revisionist thinkers.
May you live in interesting times.
My guest this evening is Ryan Dawson. Ryan is the proprietor of the ANC report. That's the Anti-Neocon Report. Ryan, how are you doing?
That's good. It's good to be with you again.
Well, thanks for coming back on the show. Any new projects since we last talked that you're working on right now? Want to plug?
Well, I mean, obviously, I'm dissecting the presidential debates between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Mm-hmm. Tweedledumber. Tweedledum and Dumber.
Tweedledevil and Tweedledeviler. Yeah.
Well, Hillary's clearly more evil.
But... Yeah, I think she has a higher body count, significantly.
Yeah, basically Trump says offensive things and Hillary's murdering children. And somehow, they still like her.
You know, that's funny. Quickly, we get on our major topic tonight. I was wondering if this whole thing, the Trump tape from Access Hollywood or something, if that was a plant by the Trump campaign to bait the Clinton campaign.
Right? It might as well have been because it's like... Well, if you go that low,
oh yeah,
you're opening the door because the Clintons, both of them, have so many skeletons. I mean, she's defended rapists and laughing about it. Bill Clinton's raped women. But worse than all that rape and what she says about women, if I was on the stage, I'd be like, Hillary, you've murdered hundreds of thousands of women.
Mm-hmm.
She supported the UN sanctions on Iraq and starving children to death by the hundreds of thousands. That's aside from all the warmongering escapades she supported and what she's done as Secretary of State, aiding Al-Qaeda, giving guns to drug cartels. Like, she has been responsible for the deaths of a million people, minimal.
Yeah, but Ryan,
half of them are women. Like, if you don't care about men for some reason, like, that's totally immoral.
That's policy, though. We can't hold public officials accountable for their actions.
When a government does it, it's okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I think Bill Clinton made that distinction about terrorism. He just back in the 90s, he said it's non-state actors or non-sanctioned violence.
Right. It's non-sanctioned violence. The parasite class didn't do it. So if you run a plane into a building, it's terrorism. If you fly a plane over a building and drop a bomb on it, it's just state policy.
It's just policy. Nothing personal.
They're letting 9,000 ISIS fighters flee Mosul right now and go back into Syria. Saudi Arabia and the U.S. say, here, we're gonna attack Mosul. You might want to leave. Oh, here's a corridor for you. It's unbelievable. And
well, they got to stir things up to keep the arms contracts flowing and the drugs flowing and the world a mess. So justify. Their positions and their jobs. You know, there's geostrategy. How else are you going to destabilize Europe if you're not creating problems in the Middle East?
This has been such a long plan that so many people have been talking about for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And here it comes, and it's exactly what we've been saying forever. And it doesn't matter. They act, what's going on in Syria? Why are all these refugees? What is happening? And you just... want to smack your head into the desk.
Yeah.
This is what we said. This is, they literally wrote it down for you. And people have read it to you, and you still are clueless.
Well, as Alan Dulles said, Americans don't read, nor do they listen very well. They don't listen very well either.
Nor do they remember more than 4 months.
Yeah.
If that. Not just Americans, anyone really. Something will happen. Look, do you not – for example, the gas attacks in Syria that were blamed on Assad, did they just forget that there were prior gas attacks by the rebels? That the reason the UN inspectors were there during the third gas attack was to inspect what happened with the second gas attack?
Yeah, we can't be expected to remember these details when we're trying to keep up with travails of Tom Brady, you know, his suspension from the NFL and what's going on in Hollywood and who's divorcing whom, who's marrying whom. And I mean, it's just too much.
So. Was Tom Brady the guy in Ted 2? Is that same person? That's how I learned who that was.
Yeah, that's funny.
So, or is that TiVo something? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's Breads and Circuses, and that's always.
I don't
always,
like people bashing on football either. Like, I don't live in the U.S., so I can't keep up with it. But I don't care if people like sports or not. Like, I played sports. I like sports. But the point is, whether it's sports or celebrity gossip or whatever, it's fine to like all that stuff. I like UFC fighting, for example, or something. It's okay, but just don't let it completely distract you from news, too. You know, it doesn't have to be either or. That's another false dichotomy. Like, you can enjoy all that and still keep up with what's going on. And I hear a lot of snarky people say, oh, well, they're the Kardashians or something. I don't know anything about Kardashians. But if that's someone's thing, that's okay, as long as they also keep up with the news.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, like, even if it wasn't them, it would be something else. They're not going to pay attention to news because they just don't care. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, they'll be obsessed with the intrigues of, say, fantasy football and the player stats and their performance. And so they have the mental capacity. They just don't – they don't have the – they're not devoting, I think, the amount of time.
They just, they don't see the whole picture immediately why and how it affects their life. Not that fantasy football does either, but they don't see the consequences of it. And so they don't really have the motivation to get into it to – the same, like, I think Chomsky said the same thing you just said, the mental aptitude it takes to memorize baseball statistics and the first to do this and that and all is the same. Like, it's not like politics is that much more difficult. It's just a little bit more boring, I guess, if you can't see how it relates to the real world. And that's with any subject. It could be mathematics, science, whatever. But those who do see how have a much stronger motive and can study a lot more. And I think that's the case with people who do become scientists, mathematicians, historians, etc. So I think there's a motive issue there. That's just from my point of view on education. You have to start, if you're a teacher, you have to give the students the proper motive and reason. Like, why are we doing this junk, like, day one? Or else...
Yeah.
It's just a struggle the whole time, in my opinion.
Yeah. It's a sound pedagogical method to find an interest. I was listening to a guy talk. Brett Vinat runs the School Sucks Project. And he was talking about he tutored kids and tried to motivate kids who were having a problem in the typical school setting, the classroom setting, brick and mortar operations. And he found a kid, you know, he was bright, just wasn't performing well in the school. But he loved the myth of Bigfoot. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, well, let's do some research there. And he got him doing research on Bigfoot, and this motivated him to learn geography, history, weather, even philosophy. And it developed from that, out of that interest, you know. So you can, he had a reason why he was learning these. He had an objective to learn these things, you know, and so it helps with that.
I feel like you can get kids interested in reading by reading things that are interesting. But what we do is we try to find the most neutral, unoffensive to everybody type of material, which ends up being pretty bland.
Yeah.
And that's just not good. A better segue has got to be tailored, and it's up to parents, because the school is strapped by rules and, you could talk to people in the face, but it is how it is. You got to read to your kids, and it could be Marvel comic books. It could be whatever that – there's no excuse. There's definitely something interesting in a book.
Yes, yeah.
The get them into that and into reading, whether Game of Thrones or something. I don't know if that's good for kids, but something interesting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it can be weaponized. You got to be careful, and it has been. Sure. So, but with tonight's topic is, well, I invited you on to talk. You had a couple of very interesting interviews with Jeffrey Blankfort regarding Zionism and the Israeli lobby and Jewish power, both in this country and abroad. And
yeah, he sued the ADL and he beat them too.
Yeah. And it's clear to any student of history and honest observer of contemporary politics that the Jewish political lobbies exert incredible power and disproportionate influence over America. Tonight I want to discuss that influence they've enjoyed. Over American life in general and also American U.S. government's foreign policy. So this story
– this is a very important topic, and yeah. I'm glad you're bringing this up, and I'm glad you asked me about this and listened to Jeffrey Blankfort. He would be good to talk about to talk to for this issue too. I mean, you and I have covered some – we're all over the field.
Yeah.
The American Civil War. We talked about narcotics and the mafia, and now we're talking about the history of Zionism. But
and also
actually, all those things relate.
Also terror bombing too, World War II and all that. So
that's right.
So this is, our fourth discussion. But this story probably begins around the late 19th century when Zionism developed its political maturation under, I guess it was Theodor Herzl.
Yeah.
His book, The Jewish State.
That's a good place to start. I agree. However, I think you'd also have to say even in ancient history, because a lot of Zionists, there's a portion of Zionists who really are religious zealots that really think that, you know, King Solomon was a real person and built literally follow the Torah or the Old Testament, a part of the Bible, and think God's a real estate agent, and that Jews were an ethnic majority in Palestine, and it used to be this country called Israel, and it was taken away from them, and they returned there in the 40s. And that's just fiction. It's a big problem between real history and religious history. Not all the history in the Bible is BS, but most of it is. And they get very confused about this. Well, I'd say even if it was 100% true, nobody racially inherits land. You know, England used to be Roman, so let's kick the British out and give it to Italy or something. It's just such an asinine concept to come in and say my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy peed here, so I'm going to bulldoze your house down and take your land. You can't take away private property from people already living there with such a ridiculous claim as God gave it to me. But so that you have to just acknowledge that, because that is a problem, a real problem. Like settlers in the West Bank today honestly believe in this religious justification for theft. So that's part of it. And then you have your atheist wing also, people who know it's not true but say it anyway because they want their stuff. Yeah.
And that would
hurts for sure.
That might be the motivation behind I know the Rothschilds were a major factor in the fulfillment of the Zionist project, and this might have been goes back to maybe their role as international bankers and geostrategy. And this also coincides with the interest of the British Empire. British philo-Semitism dates as far back as Oliver Cromwell. Because he had support of the Jews in Holland for his efforts against, you know, Charles I.
The British are very they're responsible. They do this all the time.
Yeah.
They did this with Pakistan. East and West Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh and Pakistan, they, as just a matter of a tactic, especially during World War I, they did this literally. They would promise certain ethnic groups a lot of things. Oh, if we win, you'll get this territory, this land, and they would foster what I call ethnic nationalism, whether it's the Kurds or the Jews or the Sauds or the whatevers. They would, to break up the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is controlling all these different Arabic groups. And so they would find the old tribes and promise them all the same things. Of course, they couldn't possibly deliver to all of them since they're promising all of them the same land. but whatever it took to divide and conquer and get them to uprise against the Ottomans from within is what the British would say, and they worried about fulfilling the promises later. The first thing they do is win the war. Clever tactic happens to make a mess, and it certainly has. But people so often start the story in the middle, and you really have to go back to World War One and how the British had promised the Zionists this land. I mean, Sykes-Picot anyway was horrible all by itself. I mean, it's the French and Brits just drawing circles around resources and creating new countries that had no relationship whatsoever to the reality on the ground and the people and the cultures there, or even sometimes the language.
And, Chris, what you're referring to, the Balfour Declaration, 1917.
Sure, the Balfour Declaration. Yeah. Like, who are you to give away someone else's land?
Now, the Balfour Declaration behind that was Zionist intrigue, of course, but there was this one Chaim Weizmann, this British financier, who behind the Balfour Declaration, behind the British promise for a Jewish homeland, is the this deal made between, I guess, Jewish financiers in England and their friends in the United States and the circle that surrounded Woodrow Wilson. And the intrigue. This is, I'm talking about Samuel Untermeyer.
But this is the pull them in, the Americans into the war too.
Yeah, the pull, and this would tip the balance and defeat and lead to the defeat of Germany. Because prior to that, Jewish opinion was marginally in favor of Germany. And then this, the Balfour Declaration, the promise of the Jewish homeland, and that changes sides because the Jews until that time, just organized Jewry, the Jewish wealthy class, the Jacob Schiffs, the Untermeyers. The Baruchs, they had antipathy towards Russia, right? And this is why they had supported the Bolsheviks. And, of course, factoring that is also British strategy and the Wahlbergs and all that. They had arranged for both Lenin and Trotsky to get shipped back into Russia, you know.
The Wahlbergs are another prominent banking family. Yeah. The Rothschilds tend to get all the glory because of – basically because internet films made it that way, but – Bill Still, thanks a lot. It's amazing what a buzzword Rothschild came above these other groups. And it wasn't like that in the 90s when, you know, I was talking about it to people. But now, I mean, the Rothschilds are definitely prominent, though. That's why they're featured on Israeli money and have streets named after them in Israel, definitely.
But it's more like when you say Rockefeller, Rothschilds, we're talking more about a milieu or a class than a rather or a kind of a combination of interest than opposed to like maybe a family. It started out that way because they had, you know, sons in the major cities, and they operated transnationally. That kind of shapes the values and ways of the international bankster class now, you know, how they're,
yeah, I guess in the U.S. you have the same buzzword types. It's Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, maybe Carnegie, like, but there are so many others, and it's just interesting to me, like, how one slot becomes so famous over another. Like, why is Einstein so more famous than Whitehead and Planck and all these other scientists? You know, just because he had crazy looking hair and it was a fun thing. It's interesting to me that who becomes so celebrityized or whatever is a word. They become so iconic when there's others who are just as nasty or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you need a face to market something. It's Einstein and science or Betty Crocker and cakes, you know. So,
well, see, it's I was talking about this the other day with a Korean lady. It's really an American thing how we love to be like the first to do X. Oh, he was the first man to do blah blah blah. First person to fly around the world. First person to do this. And in our science, in our history, in the history of whatever, we have these sort of heroes. Like in Japan, the brand is more important than the individual, I think. And so, you know, Sony, you know, Panasonic, you know, the Japanese brands, but you don't know the founder. You don't know. There's no like famous, iconic Asian guy. Even there, obviously somebody started it, but in the U.S. you know, Steve Jobs, you know, Bill Gates, you know, Walt Disney, you know, it's a part of U.S. culture to just, you need a king. Like it's, you got to have the dude or whatever. And really, the Thomas Edison, the whatever. And yeah, these are all great individuals, but it was whole industries that were really making what happened, you know? And it's just a weird way that the U.S. or American culture sort of filters. And on one hand, you sort of know it's not just the guy. On the other hand, all the credit and all the blame is given to the face. Like, you have these presidential debates right now with Trump and Hillary saying what they're going to do with taxes and all that. Trump wants to cut taxes. Hillary's going to raise taxes on everyone because that's what the payroll tax does, but she keeps saying 1%. But when is the president in charge of that? Congress sets that stuff up. So but we want to have the face, and we act like they're in charge of everything. This is sort of we need a king syndrome. And so that's interesting. And I try and be careful in history to be like, it's this family or this guy. And because people think like that is why they believe in, you know, a pyramid structured Illuminati and da da da.
Thus legends are born, and it simplifies everything. That's what it is. And that's mass society, mass education, mass politics is all about simplification. And we all know the devil's in the details. And so complexity is there, an allergic reaction to complexity and nuance in discussing these things, but that helps the powers.
The devil had a top hat and got shot in Virginia.
Interesting. We were talking. We're going back to the Balfour Declaration, Chris. This promise is made to the Jews about a Jewish homeland in Palestine. But up until then, Jews were considered. You know, they were dispersed throughout various nations, and they it wasn't really identified them as having any particular political power. It's something that was tangible, you could identify. Yet there's this document called the Landman Document regarding Palestine and the Balfour Declaration. This is 1918. This is during the war. And it was
– I would mention too that Judaism was basically, like, prior to all that, was a loophole around the Islamic and Catholic ban on usury.
Yes,
and that gave, well, then I'll just be Jewish where then I can do it.
a footnote in – it gave me an advantage in finance, particularly when the banks started, you know, commonly practicing fractional reserve banking. It makes it even, all the worse. It makes usury all the worse when that happens because it's unstable. But here, this Landman document, it was a letter sent to the British government. This is the British Empire, 1918. And I guess you could say geographically it's at its peak, although it's coming apart, I think. But I'll read it to you, and this is interesting because it reveals so much about the reality of Jewish power. As early as 1918, this is 30 years before the founding of Israel, and addressing the British government as if they were speaking to an equal, they said in effect, this is from the World Zionist Council, I believe, or Jewish Congress, I think. It goes, you forget that you did not give us Palestine as an unsolicited gift. This is the Balfour Declaration. It was handed over as a result of a secret bargain concluded between ourselves. We have scrupulously observed our part in bringing America into the war on your side. We call on you to fulfill your obligations in turn. You are aware of our power in the United States. Take care that you do not attract the hostilities of Israel. Otherwise, you will come up against grave international difficulties. And this is a threatening letter to the British Empire.
Yeah.
And this is the power.
They had the U.S.
Yes. And so that illustrates, at least gives an idea of the dispersed yet somehow – immense power, I guess, particularly because of finance that they could bring to the fore against governments, particularly the British Empire, but how they could manipulate the United States into the war. Of course, there are other interests at the time. You had the Powder Trust, you had Wall Street, which is finance, was largely Jewish. Jacob Schiff, Untermeyer, Bernard Baruch. They also were able to make a lot of money off the war. But I think Bernard Baruch became a billionaire from the war. But many others did too, like, you know, J.P. Morgan. And they had J.P. Morgan and had underwritten much of the Anglo-French war effort. So obviously bringing America into the war socialized their risk and privatized their profits. Mm-hmm. And that, made those bonds good. And so that was one of the motivating factors in the war. But one of the ironies of it is by – bringing America to the war and bringing about German defeat, they set the stage, you know, for the rise of Hitler. So you could argue that, although some may say it may have been intended or not, because ultimately Hitler fulfilled the Zionist project, but the Jews played a big role in the rise of Hitler. Correct?
Well, I don't know if they knew exactly what they were getting when they did that.
No, but they probably didn't, but nevertheless.
The Jewish agency made the transfer agreement with the Nazis as well, which ended in 1939 when they started rounding up and shooting Jews. But that they had worked with the Nazis to get Jewish individuals to migrate to Palestine, because the plan was already there. They needed an ethnic majority, or at least a significantly large minority. And they were pushing – they always take advantage of a crisis. They did that during the fall of the Soviet Union too. We'll take your Russian Jews and bring them to Israel. And when they couldn't take advantage of a crisis, they created one, which is what happened in the 50s. They were bombing synagogues in Iran and Egypt and wherever, and getting Jews from the Middle East to migrate to Israel. And it's always, oh, it's the new anti-Semitism, it's the new Holocaust, it's the new boogeyman. But it was them themselves. It was Irgun and these terrorist groups from Israel that were bombing different targets and even attacking other Jews in order to force Jews to flee and migrate to Israel. Now they live in settlements, ethnic colonization completely. And the U.S. media won't even acknowledge what a settlement is in the West Bank. It's a racial colony. It's a Jewish-only city where they can only trade with other Jews, only marry other Jews. It's worse than black and white apartheid of South Africa or segregation in the United States, far worse. And the difference is it's the current year, and we think we're so progressive. And they're openly doing this and colonizing people today. And it all relates back to this history we're going over of Zionism. So,
well, what you're saying is Zionism itself as a project, as a political program, had to stir up trouble in order to fulfill its objectives, because otherwise you couldn't get the Jews to leave Europe.
Right. Why would they leave where they are and go live in the desert for what? Unless there was some sort of pressure.
And here you have you could set the
why would Arabs go to Europe unless there was some pressure?
Exactly. And here you have groups like Israel Aid facilitating the migration of refugees into Europe.
I'm glad you caught that, because Grant Smith and I talked about that. There's a lovely book called Big Israel. And yes, one of these Israeli affinity organizations is actually profiting from sending refugees to Europe. There's a couple more I learned about when I went to Los Angeles, and I was talking with some of my Jewish friends who actually use these programs to come from Iran to the United States, and I would learn some more. And yeah, they're still getting paid to help refugees migrate, even though they're not even going to Israel and they're not even Jewish. They're still getting money, and this comes directly from the U.S. government, because the U.S. government finances these aid groups, which are turning the money in completely to these Israeli affinity groups, which is totally illegal, because these interest groups are getting money from the U.S. government. They're paid directly for – it's supposed to be a group for helping refugees, which would be fine if that's all it really was. But they're just fronts for Israeli affinity organizations that turn around and use a large portion of the money to continue lobbying efforts in the U.S. Congress for other means for the Israeli state.
Now, so basically taxpayers are subsidizing the migration into Europe, but that's an old trick. I mean, obviously we have the policy of U.S. aid to Israel, which is officially $2 to $3 billion a year, but probably much higher.
Now it's $4.9 billion.
$4.9 billion now. Yeah.
As of this summer, Obama upped the aid when he basically real quick, because I'll get back to Zionism, but this is important. He went with the Iran deal, which is amazing. People are like, why is Obama suddenly okay with the Iran deal when he was a senator? He co-authored the bill to put sanctions on Iran. And sponsored all the bills and put sanctions, got all the Europeans and Asians to go along with them. And now he wants to renege on that and lift the sanctions and give them a deal. It seemed confusing, but what happened was the MIC, which the military industrial complex, which overlaps deeply with the Zionists, they are using this pretext of an Iranian threat to put missile defense shields in Poland, Romania. They're aimed at Russia, obviously.
Yeah.
And they're using encircling Russia, and their two pretexts are Iran and North Korea. And both are completely disingenuous. I mean, they aided North Korea, wouldn't be. It's not totally disingenuous. So that's what the Iran deal was. And they're not really getting their money. And because they can't buy petrol on dollars, I know everyone has the opposite opinion, like petrodollar, that was nonsense put out by COINTELPRO. Like, they're losing money because they can't use dollars. And some of their assets are still frozen. So they've really only lifted the deal on paper. But it was ridiculous because they never had a nuclear program anyway. So they complied with all the IAEA inspections. They complied with everything. And yet all this pressure was put on them. They had sanctions placed on them for years. And, you know, Netanyahu going in with his stupid cartoon bomb and red line and all that has happened to Iran. Now, then you look at Israel. Israel not only illegally maintains a nuclear arsenal with hundreds of nuclear bombs, the way they acquired that was illegal, and they stole both technological know-how and physical material, like uranium, from the United States without any consequence.
This was a NUMEC plant in Pennsylvania?
That's what, yeah, the big one is NUMEC in Apollo, Pennsylvania. You had NUMEC. Should I go over that story, or you? I don't know how much time.
Well, I mean, we can get into the espionage. Maybe we alluded to. We can get into that.
Essentially, that yes. Phase, NUMEC. There's an interview with Grant Smith I did about that. If people are interested, but really quickly, the Israelis were stealing physical uranium from the United States and transporting it to Israel, which they used in Dimona. The Kennedys were really pissed off about this and went to inspect it. Both of them ended up dead, one allegedly by a Palestinian. But it did still came to light that they had this 97.7% enriched uranium, from which the U.S. used in its Nautilus program for Navy Trident submarines, etc. Definitely was stolen from the United States. No consequences. Then Mordecai Vanunu goes and takes pictures of the warheads, exposes it in the Sunday Times. Israel puts him in jail for 11 years for telling on them. Still nothing happens. And
he's kidnapped when he's in London, right? Illegally?
I think he was kidnapped in Italy. But
Italy, okay. Other way, another nation, almost like he was.
I don't know. He got kidnapped and thrown in prison in solitary confinement. So even when they are caught, everybody knows they have the bomb. Nothing happens. And that's why right now, as of August 11th, this is brand new, this year, there's been a lawsuit against the United States, not Israel, it's against the United States for giving aid to Israel because, and we have precedent for this in cases from the 70s, etc. The United States is not allowed to give conventional military aid to any country that possesses nuclear weapons that has not signed on to the non-proliferation treaty.
Yes, that is the Israel, law. That is the law.
That's the law.
Yes.
And Israel has not signed on to that, and they definitely have nuclear weapons, and they are getting conventional military aid from the United States. And the reason you can't do it is because by paying for their conventional military, you are freeing up cash for them to work on their nuclear program. And so Obama upped their aid to $4.9 billion. That's just in the direct aid. There's so many, they get so much more money through all these what we call IAOs, Israeli Affinity Organizations. It's way more than that. But we could cut off a big chunk with this lawsuit. And IRMAP, that brought about the lawsuit, has won twice. I mean, the reason we got the information about the Krytron triggers, which were being smuggled through Heli Trading Company, and one of the individuals on the U.S. side involved in that scandal was Benjamin Netanyahu, who's now the prime minister. So that was all the way to the top.
Is that when he was a furniture salesman in New Jersey or something?
I wonder if that's like Star Furniture in the TACA, air into Louisiana.
Exactly,
This kind of crap always happens. But the point is, there's a lawsuit right now, and I think the two ways that there you can support BDS and all that, but they're trying to make boycotting illegal, which is hilarious. Like, people can decide what they want to buy or not. You can't make them buy stuff. So, but anyway, the two methods of really fighting Zionism, you can talk blue in the face about how they're killing Palestinians and all, and it hasn't worked. But a lawsuit is a concrete method of bringing down the aid. If you bring down the aid, it all falls because they're just bribing Congress to give them money.
Yeah, because they kick back places like AIPAC, and this funds AIPAC's operations and other organizations to bribe and blackmail.
And AIPAC, again, is like one of those – the iconic face, right? AIPAC is terrible, and they are the worst. But they're really sort of the umbrella lobby for all these other little lobbies, your friends of fill-in-the-blank organizations and these –
Yeah, according to Grant Smith, there's even like inside the various foundations which do so much damage, whether it's the Ford Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation. You have, desks that are that represent Israel. To divert funding to certain areas, particularly local petitioning local and state governments. This is might why you have this effort in California, New York, against this movement to boycott Israel.
Right.
Yeah. And so
it's, that went for universities and Christian churches too.
Yeah,
the Presbyterians for. Oh, it was 2001 when I started working with them. Wow, 15 years before it could, didn't seem like it was that long.
And the suborning of Christianity by the part of organized Jewry is long, and that goes back to the funding of the Scofield Bible and the Christian Zionism, this theology to give it some sort of developed.
Well,
this
religion
theology.
Is always infiltrated by the state.
Yes,
it's the crazies that get to be on television and ask for money and get millions of dollars. So
like Pat Robertson
Haggard's worse than Robertson because he was having,
he had queer prostitutes.
I was trying to think of a polite way to say it. He was having a gigolo basically and doing crystal meth, crank. So he's doing drugs and having sex, adultery, and homosexual. Not that I have a problem with that, but he's preaching against it, right? So it's hypocrisy.
Well, there's that, and there's also what we have there, I think, as a telltale sign of bribery and blackmail operation going on there.
Exactly. And that, Dennis Hastert, again, Speaker of the House, raping little boys. These are the kind of people that purposely get promoted into positions of power, not only in Congress, but in the church, too.
Judges. That's what Sybil Evans said. She was talking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've talked to her privately about that. It's scary how compromised a lot of these judges are. That's why they could judge the traffic, this and that. But when it comes to the Israeli issue, they are done. So we got to get a clean judge for this lawsuit or it's over.
Well, I mean, how do you do business with an honest man if you're these people, right? You can't. Go before a judge who isn't compromised. He might rule against you.
But I don't think people understand the degree of blackmailing that is going on right now in Congress, and it's enormous.
It's an industry.
DC Madame, it's huge. It's a really huge industry. It's in the British government too.
Jeffrey Epstein. His connections to the Mossad through Ghislaine Maxwell, Robert Maxwell, Mossad agent, and his house being wired for audiovisual. This goes back to the Franken scandal, and this was a Republican thing with the Craig Spence in the 80s.
Larry King,
and it's sordid, it's horrible, and it's weird, and it's demonic and all that stuff. But the bottom line is, you have a blackmail operation. That's how the intelligence agencies, whether it's the CIA, Mossad, French intelligence. It's kind of like a community. They all kind of work together, I think.
Well, Mark Rich and Pincus Green were involved in that child trafficking nonsense, and DynCorp was bringing prostitutes to Hillary Clinton too, with the Clinton Foundation. I know this because I had a family member who was in the Secret Service and was Hillary Clinton's bodyguard. And Equatorial Guinea, for example, they brought all these Nigerian prostitutes to her security detail, just like, here, have a hooker, compromising these people. And my relative was a staunch Catholic, like, wouldn't take part in that.
He just does
doing his job and everything, but
he won't.
That was rare. There were a lot of them just took up the opportunity. He was a pallbearer for President Ford. He's one of them. They had lots of pallbearers. It was sort of an honor, but
yeah.
The last time I saw him was on TV.
So
he passed away. But Hillary, the stories, what both the Clintons are into is really, really disgusting. It's stuff I can't say on air. Like, it's really the sexual stuff they do to kids, and it's really disgusting. And so when I heard those accusations of these women who have been raped, I'm like, that's not even the tip of the iceberg right there.
So it's the whole system is so corrupt, and that's what people don't understand who are just outside it, who watch the retail level of politics, and they take it, you know, how it's this kind of take the conventional narrative and go with it, and just below the surface is this horrible underworld, and you know,
that's what happens. You're a Spitzer or a Vitter or somebody that speaks out against Wall Street. Suddenly your sex scandal is revealed and discovered in the news, right?
That's right. Palfrey got in trouble because she shut down her operation, if I recall.
She ended up dead.
Yeah, I mean, her legal troubles began when she shut down her escort operation because the FBI was using it as intelligence.
Exactly.
I think that's how the chronology played out. Then, well, after going on Alex Jones,
Charles
saying,
Kushner is another one. You know, Charles Kushner was one of these real estate moguls that set up the honey trap for Governor McGreevy of New Jersey, the governor of New Jersey.
Yeah,
he was sleeping with a honey trap for Kushner. Kushner's son owns the New York Observer, by the way, which is the very first paper to report about anthrax of 9/11.
Ah, yeah, yeah. And of course, I think you mentioned in one of our interviews that the Israeli agent involved in that one wasn't even homosexual, so he's quite a trooper.
No, he was literally taking one for the team. He wasn't even gay. Was his name? Gillen or something.
Yeah, I hope he got a medal, like the guy who did the Levon affair got. But
I hope he has nightmares.
Jeez.
Pinhas Levon, that goes back to what we're saying. Good segue.
Yeah. So but actually, 50s, what I wanted to get into first, the 1930s.
Sure.
Before we get into that. Because that's a critical period because, of course, that's the run-up to the Second World War. And you have all the events going on in Germany. Of course, you have the 1933, once Hitler comes to power, the World Jewish Congress declares economic warfare on Germany. Germany responds to the Nuremberg Laws, and of course, that dialect starts to form, and the situation is aggravated. But here in the United States, in around the late
30s,
that was
prior to Kristallnacht, too.
Yeah, exactly, Kristallnacht. Yeah, so they're agitating. At the very least, they're agitating. And, of course, you can blame the German government for their response, too. I mean, there's a dialect here that's going.
Yeah, I mean, that.
Yeah. But in the United States, you have this run-up to the war, and you have the influence of both the British and the Jewish lobby here in the United States. We had here a bona fide American hero, Charles Lindbergh, who joined the American First Committee. And of course, the American First Committee was dedicated to keeping America out of yet another war in Europe. And he gave a speech in Des Moines, Iowa in 1941. And he pretty much said this. He said, this is his quote, "The three most important groups who have been pressing this country toward war are the British, the Jewish, and the Roosevelt administration. Behind these groups, but of lesser importance, are a number of capitalist, Anglophiles, intellectuals who believe that the future of mankind depends upon the domination of the British Empire. Add to these the communist groups who are opposed intervention until a few weeks ago." I guess he's referring to the invasion of Russia. This is this late summer 1941. "And I believe I have named the major war agitators in this country." Now, for that speech, he's been called an anti-Semite. He pretty much his public life was ruined, although I think he did patriotically join the war effort after that. Turns out he was right.
It's odd that he wouldn't call him anti-British, or it's just that.
Yeah.
It's because of because of film, really, because of all the pictures of the starving people during the Holocaust that people, you know, rightly are disgusted by it. And so that people are very sensitive. So when you do talk, but look, there are Jews who are racist too, and there are Zionists who are absolutely racist and engage in ethnic cleansing and racial colonization and all that. But to oppose that, rather than opposing their actions, people think you're opposing them like as a biological category as Jews. So it's anti-Semitism. And it's ridiculous. So I always bring up the example of North Korea, biologically the same as South Korea, same language and everything. When you oppose the Kims, no one says you're anti-Asian or anti-Korean. Like, it's clearly against a state. But when you oppose Israel for their same horrific actions – maybe a little bit less than North Korea, But why do people think that you hate the Jews? Like, it's not the Jews. It's Israel and Israeli policies. And the Jewish interests, that's what they mean. They don't mean all the Jews got together in a room or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a Zionist interest. That's what they mean.
Well, it's like people say the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Right.
And of course, it was the Japanese military. That's what they mean.
Yeah, yeah. But that's part of the word game, or at least the psychological warfare, whereas how they control public discourse in the matter, because to oppose the Israeli state or to highlight the intrigues, the crimes of the Mossad, or say the disproportionate influence that the Jewish lobby controls in this organized Jewish community, or to criticize Hollywood, which they boast they control Hollywood. So if you criticize the moguls who control Hollywood and the products they produce, you're considered an anti-Semite, although they brag about controlling Hollywood. So if you're going to take credit for controlling Hollywood, you have to take responsibility for what Hollywood produces. And that's a legitimate criticism in my book. There's an ethnic component here, of course. There always is. We have no problem identifying the ethnic component when we're talking about, you know, like the Italian mafia, right?
Right, or any other one. And the thing is, it's because of that it can thrive. Because racism works if there's no stigma against it. Like, the natural consequence of any group being so voraciously, you know, nepotistic and favoring themselves and being prejudiced to everyone else is that everyone else realizes that and there's a backlash towards it, and which is what crushes it. But because of the Holocaust, which is so horrible and giving all the focus over every other death in the Holocaust in history, they are allowed to openly practice this form of ethnic nepotism and racism without the natural backlash that would have been met if whites or blacks or anyone else behaved the same way. So that's how you acquire Hollywood and media and things, because people won't speak out and say, hey, how come you're only hiring each other? And no one wants to say it because no one wants that label, because then you're a Nazi and you throw babies in ovens or something.
Yes. Or make soap out of them, or lampshades, or
the ridiculous exaggerations of World War II.
Put them in cages with gorillas and eagles, or something. Have them fight it out, or
I believe that was in the New York Times. It was a bear and an eagle.
A bear, that's what it was.
Not a gorilla. So, come on now.
Sorry, get my animals messed up here.
Do you know Louis Libby? This is interesting. This is why it reminded me of Sickos, since we were talking about Deborah Jean Palfrey and eagle and a bear. Here's my segue into how this morphs together. Louis Libby, who was Dick Cheney's chief of staff, part of the Plame Affair, huge architect for the Second Iraq War, he wrote a book where, you know, it's like his own fantasies, where underage Japanese girls got raped by a bear in a cage. Like, they had trained a bear to rape.
That's right. Yeah, I remember reading about
and
that. Yeah.
You get into the mind of these sick. How does someone even think of that? You know. Even a Japanese manga wouldn't think of that.
Yeah, yeah.
They got everything, but not that. So that's – ooh. You know, that's the kind of people we're dealing with. And he was a lawyer for the Mossad agent, Mark Rich, who Bill Clinton pardoned, who was involved in child trafficking.
Yeah, and he ran off to the
– East Rich financed Hillary Clinton's Senate run.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it wasn't Mark Rich. It's Denise Rich. It's his wife's money, not his money. He's a fugitive. The Clintons love to bend the law, you know, like, oh, I tested the underwear and there was no blood. It's like, because you cut the section out with all the blood on it and tested the other half.
Yeah.
How do you get away with that? She needs to be shot in the head. I'm sorry.
Like, uh-oh. See, oh, wait, you're in Japan. You can say
go ahead. Right. Yeah, whatever.
Well, after
with the water pistol, there you
okay,
go.
With a pot. Okay, well, yeah, I wish her a long,
extremely high-powered water pistol.
Yeah, you know, I don't wish her ill health or anything. I wish her a long, healthy life behind bars.
Sure, I wish her a long, unhealthy life behind bars. It would be nice, you know, if justice were to be served. People like Hillary, John McCain, all that—they would be in a zoo. They would be in a zoo where people could gawk at them and throw tomatoes at them and stuff. That's where they belong.
Instead of, you know, I guess, bowing at their feet and calling her Madam President, as we're probably going to get.
Why are people supporting her? It's, you know what it is. It's all this identity politics.
Well,
Trump
first
got
woman
painted,
friend,
you know, in the media of being some xenophobic, racist, you know, monster or whatever. And the need to virtue signal outweighs everything else. I mean, you can straight up, I've done this, you can point out how Hillary's support is starving all those kids. She's doing it right now in Yemen. There's little babies, little children can't defend themselves. Just little kids, bones showing and everything. They're starving to death.
I had some technical difficulties. I lost my internet there. I'm sorry about that, Ryan.
Yeah, I'm used to living in a first world country, so it can happen to anyone. Usually my problems are my gear is cheap and it breaks.
But they have to do everything on the cheap. So
yeah, so I have to replace this mic soon. But well, we were talking about identity politics,
yeah,
I think.
In the election.
And that's really strong with millennials especially. It's they've been hit hard by all these social networks and stuff that promote this crap because – you know, memes favor, as George Carlin said, you know, symbols are for the symbol-minded. And that's kind of what's happened with Facebook and the rest of this stuff. You can point out to people how Hillary's murdered children. There's no way around it. I mean, she starved to death all those kids in Iraq. They're starving to death little kids in Yemen right now. It's really sad. I mean, you see these pictures of these poor children, babies, their bones poking through their skin and they're dying, and the U.S. just today directly intervened in Yemen with their warships, and they're supporting Saudi Arabia bombing these the poorest country in the Middle East, being attacked by the wealthiest country in the Middle East with the world superpower, and Hillary's all for it. She doesn't care about justice or anything. You can add to that Libya, Benghazi especially, Bahrain, Iraq, Syria. She's been a butcher, Kosovo, and what they care about is they can forgive all that, her murdering hundreds of thousands of people, wasting trillions of dollars. They forgive everything because Trump said something that could be construed as, you know, getting against Mexicans or something, and the need to virtue signal is so strong to prove they're not a racist or xenophobic, sexist, something, 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 ism. That's, you know, Carlin talked about this too. If they can get you about race, sex, sexual preference, income, whatever, dividing people, that's all that matters to these American kids, these younger generation, is virtue signaling. Just to be like, look, I'm anti-Trump. That means I'm not racist. That is the thing. It's racist is on the tip of the tongue. You're ready to call everything racist. And it's a kind of a mic dropping thing, like xenophobic, bigot, racist, something, just some sort of prejudice. And you know who's obsessed with that are people who are actually prejudiced or struggling with it. I was watching the debates in horror how they're pandering to demographic categories, you know, the Latinos, the Hispanics, the African Americans. You don't have to list everyone, you know, just say people. Just say inner cities or whatever. If you're talking about a certain area, I get it, but.
Because you're always going to forget someone and offend somebody then, right?
Yeah, right. I know. Their vice presidential picks are, you know, purely based on swing state votes. That's all it is. It's all manipulation. They are both horrible. But for all the offensive or misogynist stuff that Trump has said as, you know, an alpha male billionaire New Yorker, I'm sure not a lot of people around him say no. But okay, he says offensive stuff, but whatever, Hillary's been killing people and defending rapists and aiding Al Qaeda and terrorists all over the world. You can't get any worse than her. And yet the need to virtue signal is so strong. That's all that matters. They're scared to support Trump, and their support for Hillary is completely just a way of wearing their anti-prejudiceness on their sleeve. And it's ironic because she is completely prejudiced. Trump has offended Muslims. Hillary's killed a million of them.
Which is worse, yeah.
Yeah,
but what it's interesting you mentioned identity politics, because this you can also trace the development of identity politics in America in the post-war era, well, to the Frankfurt School, and that's, you know, of course overwhelmingly Jewish. The idea that this idea of pluralism, this idea of tolerance, you know, the idea of diversity, all this stuff, it wasn't meant to bring peace. It's to divide and conquer the people, to make make everyone feel like they're a victim.
And it's not real diversity either.
No, it's not. No.
It's just biological diversity. Mm-hmm. They all have the same ideology.
But this was spelled out in the I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but in the 1950s, you had this publication of this book by the American Jewish Committee, The Authoritarian Personality, which said that America, traditional America, or America that was predominantly Christian, was always about to become fascist because it was a strong family, nuclear family, and the father figure, which facilitated, somehow led to the rise of Hitler. And so what they needed to do was needed to engage.
Treaty of Versailles led to the rise of
Hitler. I know. But engage more or less in cultural – it was a declaration of ethnic or cultural warfare against the majority of the American people at the time. Promoted through the authoritarian personality to go in and sort of to demoralize, undermine the values at the time was the majority values of the country. And they did it culturally through entertainment, through politics, through the development of identity politics. And this is what we're seeing the fruition now of identity politics is you can divide and conquer everybody and create this squabbling mass. And so the elite can get along with their crimes and no one cares. Because they're worried
about
what
the British did with the Iktidari system in India.
Exactly.
You've got to divide up the lower class and get the plebs and hoi polloi to fight with each other over nonsense divisions of biological categories, sexual preference, what have you.
Well, I think it's interesting.
And that's what they focus on.
Is this strategy in part by the Jews, by the Frankfurt School, the American Jewish Committee, has been attributed to a reaction to Hitler and the experience of the World War and the Holocaust. But this strategy was identified long before the war, because I think it was in Bela Kun's regime in Hungary, his cultural director, Georg Lukács, who engaged in cultural warfare against the Christian society in Hungary for the very same reason, to demoralize, to divide and conquer. So this is a strategy that's been around, was around long before Hitler. So to blame it on the Second World War is a misdirection, I think.
Feminize the men, masculinize the women, flip gender roles around, do all that. And you're really confusing people. They've invented a new gender.
Yes, and this also it plays into the depopulation agenda that's occurring too, because obviously feminized men and masculine women aren't going to make a lot of babies, at least not in my estimation.
It's also just something there's such a need to run and take a pissing contest for victimhood on the victimhood tree that if you look at it, it's a lot of like young middle class, upper class whites that are attracted to this nonsense.
Yeah.
But when homosexuality was really taboo, it was mostly white guys. When transgender, et cetera, carry some social stigma, like gothic kids or whatever, it's white people. Like, because if they can't have the victimhood of race, then they'll make it sexual identity instead and be like, well, I'm gay, or now I'm transgender, or something that they get attracted to. The dietary stuff's the same way. It's almost all white people are vegan, or it used to be vegetarian. That's not enough now. I'm vegan, and now there's so many different things. I can't even – paleo this and that I have organic pre-fraud. It's nuts. But who's eating that up? It's part of the inculcation of white guilt that are pushed on these children, really, that they grow up needing to find something they can become a victim to so that they can relieve this part of the guilt that's been pushed on them. And it's all collectivism. I mean,
yes,
Western society ended slavery around the world. They should be proud of that if you're going to be collectivizing.
Yeah.
And yet it's the opposite. They get blamed for all of it.
At a certain point, white guilt or guilt in general becomes pathological. And even the idea of whiteness, which is sort of a generic thing, is that's a product. The white middle class was a product of a psychological warfare operation conducted, by the WASP elite and the Jews when they destroyed the ethnic neighborhoods in the United States to create, suburbia. And this coincides with the development of the interstate highway system. It's all military planning, social engineering.
It's all better for factory work,
Exactly. And that's what they did when they shipped up the workers, sharecroppers in the north to break up the weaken the unions and the industrial centers. This was part of the World
Rust
War.
Rust Belt towns.
Yeah. And this is all part of, weaponized migration. There's a difference between natural migration and integration or immigration, as opposed to it can be weaponized and mass migration. I mean, it's the difference between people coming and going into the country like occurred in maybe the United States in the 1950s. like in the Southwest area, where you could argue that's a Tex-Mex culture, and so it's not so much an issue there. I talked to people who lived down there in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and to them, there was never an immigration issue, although there were, people were crossing the border all the time. But when you have mass migration because of a contrived war, that changes the calculation a little bit. It's different.
Yeah, I'm learning how to condense stuff in the memes because that's how you talk to millennials.
Yeah.
And so my meme for all that is, if you export bombs, you will import refugees.
Yeah. And then if you import a lot of, I don't know, let me say if you bring in a lot of single males into an area out of a war zone that are alienated from the host culture, you're going to get a lot of crime, a lot of rapes, more than usual, right? And that aggravates the situation. And the worst thing about that is that outcome is intended. That's right. A desired outcome by the social engineers who want to destroy the ethnic basis of European states because they want to divide. I was wishing to listen.
At the same time, it gets people to support the invasions and wars against those evil people.
Yeah, we got to go fight them. But like, what?
And it cycles.
Yeah. And James Corbett, doesn't him talk about this, he said that this might be a dialectic that's being created to encourage what they call a European identity as opposed to German, French, you know, mm-hmm. Polish identity, breaking up the ethnic basis of these countries, which has been a stated objective. I think Wesley Clark said that. You know, the former head of NATO said that the idea of the ethnic-based German European country is passé. We're going to end that. Well, who are you to end this? And what type of policies are you and your superiors going to engage in? This is, I mean, obviously you're admitting to some high-level malfeasance, social engineering, coercion, war, violence, all these things. This is what George Soros is doing in these things. So at some point along
the way – he also should be in a zoo.
Yes. He's another one, right? Yeah. But what we're talking about, Chris, get back to we alluded to the 30s and went up to the war and the influence of the British, particularly the Jewish party or Jewish interest in the United States and getting the country into the war. Of course, that was finally achieved with the sneak attack on Pearl Harbor, right? Hint, hint. Mm-hmm. The war, obviously, the war is horrible. 60 million people perished in that conflict. Out of that, we get the Holocaust narrative, which I think are developed out of all the confusion, war, destruction. They were able to develop this story of the narrative, the German attempt to annihilate European Jewry, and this creates guilt. And this I think, solidifies the vast majority of Jews to get behind the Zionist project. And in 1948, you had that comes into fruition with the creation of Israel. Of course, prior to that, I think you had the UN, the British leaving, the British mandate ending, and the UN mandate beginning. And the United Nations, I think at this time, says, okay, we're going to solve this conflict. Because I believe in 1920, the area was 85% Arab.
Hold on, let me stop you there. More government's going to solve it, like more government. So well, what's the UN do? Oh, we're just going to – we'll just award this land that people already live on over to this other group.
Yeah, because I mean, this is where it's important is I believe around 1920, the area that is now Israel was 85% 80% Muslim, 10% or 10 to 15% Christian, and 5% Jewish. There was a program in the 20s and 30s to migrate to the area, and by the 1948, it was 30% Jewish. I believe. But the UN mandate called for a 55% transfer, called for a division of land. Although there were Jews only 30% of the population, they were to receive 55% of the land, probably the best land. The Palestinians or the Arabs there rejected that plan, and this sparked the war, correct? Do I have that correct chronologically?
Yeah, it was more than 55%, but that, okay. You know, whatever. You're awarding land over to a group of European colonizers, essentially, mm-hmm. with a religious theme. It's European colonization with a religious theme. They're giving away their land, and of course that started an uprising. Also, the British went around and confiscated weapons and guns from the Palestinians prior to the conflict, but not the Jews.
And this coincides with the King David bombing, which was a false Israeli false flag, one of the earliest.
Well, the first King David hotel bombing, yeah.
Yeah, where they posed
one
Arabs.
One of them, right?
One of them.
Yeah. Oh, they're so disgusting.
And this precipitates the Nakba, the serial massacres and the emptying out of the villages and the seizure of the land, correct?
You know, they killed 29 Palestinians who were worshiping, praying at a mosque. Like, but they always start the story in the middle. They always like you. The Israel was reacting to Hamas or something. Like, Hamas wasn't even part of the picture for decades, you know, or neither was Hezbollah. And I mean, Hamas is the government Israel needs and wants. It's like, oh, you've got this giant bully. And what you're going to do is throw spaghetti at them as your first strike. You know,
yeah.
It just gives them. Hamas is there to offer pretext for a pounding on Gaza, and the PA has completely been purchased. Abbas does nothing. He's just like Mubarak was for Egypt, paid off to look the other way. They're helpless. The Palestinians are. They need America needs to stop giving Israel money. Israel's and the. The politicians and the people in Israel cannot fix their own problem. They're brainwashed from birth. We need outside sources to resolve this problem.
And Hamas, I believe, weren't they started by Shin Bet?
Yeah, Israel created Hamas
as a
and
foil for Fatah, right? As a to undermine Fatah, right?
Undermine the Fatah. Not that that seemed better. And the PLO is what they're really afraid of with the Fatah. So. I mean, I used to speak with Diana Butu, who's a spokeswoman for the PLO, and negotiate a lot of things. I met her at the first PSM, which is called the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, which is predated BDS. I met at Duke University down there in North Carolina, and we'd hold these events. Now we have this equally large event in Washington, D.C. annually. The fourth one's coming up March 24th with the Institute – for research in Middle Eastern policy, IRMEP, with Grant Smith's organizations and Washington Middle East Report and a lot of orgs. That's where that should have national news. And the most we've ever gotten is C-SPAN. I see all the reporters there from ABC and NBC, CBS, Fox, you know, and the newspapers. And they're go around asking questions, and they don't write any stories because they're there at trying to get a story. They're trying to interview people to try and get somebody to say something anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish, and nobody there is – no one's like that. They're all educated. I'd say 50% of the speakers are Jewish themselves, and we're just saying stop killing kids. Stop occupying territory. Stop the illegal military occupation. This is not a racial issue. This is just a moral issue. Like stop it. Stop. Why are we going to war – all these wars. We went to war in Iraq because OSP, da da da. And so it's funny to me that that's how biased the press is. They go there for a story, and they ought to be covering a story for the Palestinians, and they don't interview. You have all these smart people in the same room, and none of them get any ink. The only thing they're interested in is trying to write some hit piece and smear piece on the event, and they can't get anyone to bite on it.
Well, that's an old strategy. There's before we get into the era of false flags, just I wanted you to kind of do a rundown on examples of Israeli false flags and deception and these things. But
I actually wrote a timeline of those.
That's important, very important, because it explains a lot of these events that we've experienced in the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years perhaps. But we have this idea of a policy of dynamic silence. There was a Jewish strategy to marginalize critics. And basically it was using leveraging Jewish the power of Jewish finance over media to make sure that any critic of Israel or what the Jewish lobby wanted would simply be ignored or rendered unemployed. And this, you know, basically they – if there's a radio station had a critic on, they just threatened to pull advertising from the radio station. Same thing with newspapers. I'm sure it continues in a more sophisticated manner today.
Group can do that too, minority or not. You get your busybodies together.
Alison Weir, in her book, mentions the case of Dorothy Thompson, who was a nationally syndicated columnist, very, very popular news lady in the 40s and 50s. And in fact, she was kicked out of Germany for being critical of Hitler prior to the war. And she was considered a friend of Zionism up until the 1950s when she started to write and produced a documentary about the plight of the Palestinian refugees. And she found herself – she lost her national syndicated radio show, lost her column, and died ignored. because of her criticism.
You know, If Americans Knew was also at the Palestinian Solidarity Movement back in, I think I saw them there in 2005 or 4. They were there too, Alison Weir.
Yeah, that's
before her. I knew who she was. But I think that's when, may have been when they started, but they were there. Yeah, that's a tactic they do to academics too. I mean, Norman Finkelstein, for example, like, you will not get tenure and you can lose your job if you simply speak out against a horrible racial apartheid. And it's really amazing because they're getting labeled racist for doing the opposite. I mean, yes, obviously the Zionists are racist. They have policy of racial apartheid, Jewish-only cities on land confiscated by force. There is just no way around it. They are definitely not interested at peace. You cannot simultaneously colonize and occupy your neighbors and preach that you just want peace and you won't trade land for peace. What you mean, trade stolen land? We won't quit stealing land just for peace. That's what you ought to say if you're honest. Like, no, we can steal some more. So we don't want peace because we want to keep fighting because then we can steal more stuff. They're totally dishonest about it. But you cannot say this on mass media anywhere in the United States. Never. It's career suicide. As the FBI said, talking about 9/11. We can't talk about information of the Israelis' involvement in 9/11. It's classified information and it's career suicide.
Well, now we're getting into, say, a more, I guess, sinister dimension of this and perhaps more revealing about the true nature of some of these events. History of Israeli false flags.
Yes.
And of course, I alluded to the King David bombing in 1948, the King David Hotel, which was a false flag. But that seemed to sort of start a pattern here. And you and others have researched the Israeli involvement in, well, some false
There's
flags.
There's so many incidences that it's hard to remember them all. And you have to write them down because it happens like so often.
And we talked about nuclear espionage with the Israelis and the involvement of NUMEC and this a lot of the
Salman Shapiro.
Yeah. Involvement in the Kennedy, is this factored into John F. Kennedy's death and perhaps his brother?
Oh, definitely with Robert Kennedy too.
Want to go into that a little bit? Do we have time, or
can we talk about the Kennedys? How much time do we have? I don't like to sloganeer the Kennedy stuff because there's so much. Just like with 9/11, there's a lot of stupid out there about.
But I mean, basically the Kennedys putting pressure on the American Zionist Council.
Oh, they wanted to register them as a foreign agent. Yeah. They wanted to inspect Dimona for nuclear weapons, of course. You know, and you have to remember Robert Kennedy is the head of the Justice Department at the time.
Okay.
So it's not like he's just the brother of John Kennedy. One's the president, one's the head of the Justice Department. And they were going after the Israelis hardcore. Also, Kennedy supported Algerian independence, which the Israelis didn't like. They didn't want another independent Muslim nation. And there was an assassination attempt on Charles de Gaulle over that issue.
That's right.
So it's worth – you have to talk about the French connection, and I'm not talking about Lucky Luciano, that French connection, the other one. However, talking about Lucky Luciano, you really got to understand the CIA's relationship with the organized crime and the mafia at that time and their dealings with Cuba to understand the Kennedy assassination too. Because they lost $1 billion a year. That's in 1962. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, that jingle in your pocket.
Well, Castro shut down gambling operations and the Jewish mafia lost an enormous amount of money from that. And, you know, Kennedy, the CIA had been trying to kill Castro. However, Santos Traficante Jr. kept tipping him off and playing both sides.
That's right. He's a triple agent, yeah.
Exactly. That's what happens when you play with the mob. I mean, but the CIA too, like there were a lot of American businessmen that lost a lot of money, legitimate business that aren't organized crime per se, but very little difference.
Yeah.
For Cuba to compete with the massive market of the United States. So they had bought up all the beachfront property and owned all the hotels and owned everything in Cuba was owned by Americans. So Castro's pretty much nationalizing his island and kicking them out, and he shut down the casinos. of course, the mafia, using the pension money that Hoffa stole, set up Las Vegas. As if you want to have gambling illegal, except in one spot. That's the most lucrative way to have business because you have a monopoly. So you're like, it's illegal everywhere except this one city.
Yeah.
And Las Vegas basically replaced Cuba because that's what Cuba was. It was a place that Floridians and others could get to gamble legally, and that got cut off, so they built a new one.
Yeah, virtually tax-free, too, because you could just always, with the skim, you could always claim a loss.
Well, it's important for the money it generates, and yes, exactly, money laundering.
All that cash, you can filter a lot of dirty money in with the so-called clean money.
And they started that on the Indian reservations with the BIA, which I call bossing Indians around. The BIA has assassinated people. They blew up a friend of mine's house. That is a documentary where I want to, if I get my Patreon up, I want to tell that whole story.
Oh, that factors into, like, ever hear Mike Reconosciuto's story?
No.
He involves, Danny Costolero, the Octopus, in Promise Software, and developing some sort of weird weaponry on Indian reservations because they're sovereign, so you could, didn't have to worry about polluting, stuff like that. I don't know if it's true or not. I've just gotten wind of it. It's a very interesting story. It's about some defense contractors developing weird weapons on Indian reservations, and this involves.
I don't know about that, but I know they dump a lot of the nuclear waste in the, like, Shoshone and stuff.
They do the same in Africa.
The
right?
Mountains.
That's like Larry Summers.
Well, that's what Ghana is. Ghana's a giant e-waste trash can.
Yeah, then they wonder why people are getting sick in Africa, and they blame Ebola.
I know. They're burning the wires to get the metals out to sell. I'm like, just send them wire cutters. Let them if you're going to do it, give them some wire cutter strippers.
Well, that's a whole other discussion I want to have with you sometime about neo-colonialism in Africa and the whole.
Thank you, because that's my most underwatched film, and I put all this effort into it.
Well, no, it's great. I mean, because that gets into Rwanda, what's really going on.
It's really the model for any place, though. It's the same tactics.
Latin America, Asia at some point. It's a question
banana
of
banana wars.
Yeah. It's almost like a phase that the area goes through. Like China had to go through the Maoist phase in order to bring in the state capitalism phase that the Rockefellers love now.
Southeast Asia right now is a banana republic, the whole thing, basically. And
even under French rule, weren't they like food independent? Things like now they're dependent on foreign imports and stuff like that. Economically, so it's a whole – I don't know if these things just unfold or it's a long-term business plan. But, you know, I can see some exec up there with their MBAs. You know, if we bomb and destroy for 20 years, 30, 40 years from now, we can capitalize on it. You know, same way that Captain Austin Fitz says that drugs are imported into a neighborhood to bring about gentrification, eventual gentrification. You can destroy a neighborhood with drugs and then and gentrify it in 15 years. And, you know, the property, you can acquire the property on the cheap and then sell it for a profit.
You know, that was a plot in the video game Grand Theft Auto.
Do you think Hillary tried
to get that game banned? No, that's happened. That happened in Los Angeles. Like they drive property values down on purpose with gang violence and so, and they buy it up. And that's real. Real estate moguls in New York, look at all the 5 points and all these different sections from Brooklyn, Queens, or whatever. They're playing around with real estate. Giuliani's, you know, war against window wipers or whatever.
Well, this is the British East India Company model. I mean, it just plays out different ways. And, I mean, if you look at the making sense of the Rampart scandal in L.A. and, you know, and the use of rap singers to promote drugs through
Interscope Death Records. Oh boy, yeah, that's all Subner Rothstein. MTV.
Yeah, MTV and some. Of course, most
it
of
also
them Summer,
is promoting this sort of idiotic tribalism. Like,
yes,
they're trying to create an African American identity around complete ignorance and stupidity. Like, it became cool to not use proper grammar, and it became cool to be like, yo, I don't know, like, it's almost what, like, I sound like Balboa. It's stupid. Whatever. It made this group identity that did not exist before. I mean, blacks had it hard enough in the United States.
I know.
Jesus, you know, and they're going through this, and through the 60s and 70s, they're transitioning and climbing the ladder into wealth, and then MTV hits, and boy, elder black people look at what happened to the youth like, oh, you're a bunch of niggers is what they want to say. Like,
yeah,
that is, they're like, how we had to struggle and get to here, and now you got your pants around your ankles and you're doing this and that. They're completely disgusted with them. Bill Cosby, now I'm probably not the best example now. Was he even guilty? I didn't follow anything, but
I don't know. They claim he's
he's like, pull your pants up and get a job, that kind of speech. Yeah. It's like, what do you expect in this inundating people, whatever group it is, that say you're a victim and this entitlement attitude is very detrimental to them ever doing well in the workforce or in education, because
intentional degradation. But that's how else are you going to fill the prison beds, prison cells, when you have American Correctional Corporation that has a prospectus that says we need 90% occupancy to turn a profit?
You got to make a plant. You got to make a plant illegal.
Yeah, there you go, and that fills the prisons, and that's a business plan. It's not a conspiracy. It's a business plan. If you don't like the word conspiracy, call it a business model.
Yeah. Well, every covert activity ever is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
That word got – you know who made that word all tainted too?
Well, CIA, yeah.
Exactly. Who proprietate more conspiracies than
– Only a nut would accuse a secret spy organization of engaging in conspiracy.
Yeah.
I was like, what? This is the Kratocracy.
Assassination. How dare you? We just have a vision for it.
Yeah, William King Harvey or whatever his name was. Yeah. I think we got off on that tangent talking about, the intrigues of Zionism and the Kennedy assassination. But we're kind of, that's not wild speculation. You had Clay Shaw.
The ZOA morphed into AIPAC because
exactly, yeah. But the Kennedy assassination, I think it was Clay Shaw. He worked for Permadex. Permadex was owned by Tibor Rosenbaum, who's a Swiss banker or a Jewish banker who owned a Swiss bank. But it's all tied into these outfits. But I think Kennedy was putting opposition to their Israel's nuclear program. You mentioned Algeria, and so
the film I'm working on starts with it, because how do you sit down and explain this to somebody, the Kennedy thing? Because it takes so much. You can explain it to a Kennedy buff researcher, right? Because this, so here's the extra part. But to start from scratch, I focused on with Jacob Rubenstein, Jack Ruby is what everyone else calls him, who he worked for Capone when his youth and Sam Giancana, and moved down to Dallas when they were fighting over that territory. And no matter what anybody thinks, they're not going to know about Permadex and all that. That's maybe if you read Michael Piper or something, but the classic, non-Kennedy enthusiasts, maybe they saw Oliver Stone's JFK, which is horrible. Maybe they passively researched it. Everybody knows about Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, minimal, because Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly shot the president by himself and Jack Ruby shot him.
Yeah, they're the principal patsies in that operation. So,
yes, well, so because people are familiar with that, I focus on Jacob Rubenstein and all his connections to the Zionist octopus first, before getting into Guy Bannister's cell with Clay Shaw and David Ferry and all that. I usually narrate this from Ruby first, but yeah, there's so much to say about the Kennedys, and I want to make a movie about it. I want to make two movies, one for Bobby and one for John, and then wash my hands of that. But I've written it all out in notebooks is what I do before I make Empire Mask.
Have you looked into the death of Marilyn Monroe and her connections to Mickey Cohen?
Mickey Cohen? Yeah, I have. I've seen him.
So there's some connections.
Cohen, with the hotel that Robert Kennedy was killed at, was Mickey Cohen ran a gambling operation out of that hotel. He was in jail at the time of the assassination, but
the Ambassador Hotel, yeah.
Yeah, that was Mickey Cohen's territory, and Babyface and those guys were running a gambling operation right out of the lobby of the hotel. And Sirhan Sirhan was in debt $22,000 to the mob. It's a long story, but all the lawyers were mobster lawyers, prominent lawyers for other mob cases is so deep, but the mob is not independent from states, from the CIA or the Mossad. That just like ISIS or the Mujahideen, when you're talking about these criminal groups in whatever country, they are not independent from the CIA or other intelligence organizations. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, prior to 9/11, the CIA set up the Safari Club. The CIA and Mossad already had a syndicate, and they brought in the Saudis and the French and Moroccans into this larger syndicate called the Safari Club, which that's who created the Mujahideen in the 80s. That was their operation from then to now. The Safari Club has been doing jointly conducted covert operations, and they were all over September 11th. And you've seen The Empire en Masse. I know it's a five-hour film, but, like, boy, when I watch other stuff on 9/11, it's like, I think that building fell too fast. Building 7, da, da, da. You can sum it up in 8 minutes, you know. They really don't get into who did it or how or why or financing or nothing. So I spent a long time flushing that one out, and my next project's going to be JFK, because if people understood what really happened in 1963, why he was killed and who did it, and the cover-up, and it just bleeds right into The Empire en Masse. It could be one long narrative. Oh, if they knew, it would really hit the fan. Like, just explaining the USS Liberty and Johnson and Matilda Krim and the Israeli, it's all over the whole thing. And there's still people alive today who survived the Liberty attack.
Mm-hmm.
Where's that Hollywood film?
The same way it folds into Iran-Contra.
Oh, absolutely. And I spent a good deal of time on Iran-Contra and The Empire en Masse too. But yeah, again, you and I grew up during Iran-Contra, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. I was in high school.
Yeah, so
just finishing high school. You know, just out of high school, I remember, yeah. I went through a lot of the principal figures. I went to high school with their kids.
Well, there we go.
I was
in elementary school, but I remember it.
Yeah,
I remember it being
I didn't
TV.
Know. Hey, your dad's a heroin trafficker. Wow, and you're rich. Wow.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
Iran-Contra, again, the Israelis and the U.S. Worked in tandem on Iran-Contra. Selling first, it started, oh, you want some spare tires for your aircraft and things like that. But that's what the mob does too. Your lowest level, you know, mob intro dude, you know, what they do is they have them go around selling knives door to door and stuff like that, practicing their people skills and scoping the areas and that. That's what they do. Oh, have some tires. Oh, you need some.
That was the arms trade. They think the tow missiles that involves the October surprise.
Robert Perry has written a great book on that, The October Surprise.
Yeah, and people, like, when I suggested that happened, like, yeah, that's a crazy conspiracy theory. You know, listen, of all the things that the Central Intelligence Agency does, Mossad does, you know, the governments do, that's the least offensive thing they did.
Yeah, I mean, it was a conspiracy, and they admitted it. Anthony Poindexter got convicted for conspiracy. Oliver North got up there and bragged about it. Like, I did it. I mean, that dude, Ali North, he's like, so what? I wanted to fight the communists. Yes, we wanted plausible deniability. Yes, we wanted to be able to – he didn't care. He flat out – because he thought he was right still.
Yeah.
And
there were multiple agendas with that. One thing is, the program in Central America, because they want to keep Central America an arena for these civil wars. So you have a lucrative business for drugs and arms. And then the drugs flow into areas like South Central LA. And this serves the cultural agenda of, you know,
they don't want any model to rise to that clean that up economically.
No, that's what
if Nicaragua or one of these states, Grenada or something, had broken off and did well. Then others could follow.
Yeah, that's they don't want that at all. But I think
the Operation Washtub was another setup for that.
And
talk about false flags. And
what people don't realize is when they're trying to worry about their communities and drugs is well, your government, they're bringing the drugs in. Just read Doug Valentine, for Pete's sake.
Yeah, exactly.
At the local level, and if you don't understand how this works, watch Breaking Bad. Okay, they dramatize it, and it's a limited hangout. I understand that they don't show
people can get drugs in jail.
I know,
you know, like,
but it's a business.
Cops have to be part of it. ICE has to be part of it.
Narco dollars the narco dollar is probably as important as the petrodollar now. It keeps the banks liquid. It funds Wall Street. People who are sitting there saying, I'm against drugs, don't realize that their 401k plan is invested.
Black market money. It's black market money. Essential. You have to have that so they can deny the super covert things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And the CIA always uses intermediaries, and they pay them with black market money. That is the methodology of what they do. They did it in Nam. Doug Valentine and I did an interview about that, how the first thing they do is buy a property and so on. I think you and I talked about it too. But that interview has been transcribed and will be in his new book, which should be out any time. It's being just edited and it's in the final stages right now.
Well, if you have any doubts of how this works, look up the career of Paul Helliwell, a Mary Carter paint company. Now, this CIA lawyer is in business with Meyer Lansky. That doesn't illustrate in the Bahamas. You go down to Paradise Island. All this is built with drug money, okay? And that money that you're investing in, that money that's being pumped into the country, and the drugs are being sent in or being developed in the country, like methamphetamine, this stuff. There's a business plan to this stuff. And
well, how about Rothstein's bookkeeper as the investigator?
That's right. But
they rigged the World Series. I mean, The one thing like I'm these sure mafia that, I'm sure, shows, I'm sure I've never seen Sopranos or whatever, but I'm just going to guess. This is unfair, but you see these like Italian mafia movies, Godfather, what have you. It makes them famous in a way by saying, look at this, but it also makes them look way smaller than they really are.
Yes.
Because they're not just involved in bootlegging and something. The organized crime is much bigger than it's portrayed in Hollywood, much bigger. Whether it's Yakuza in Japan or, all the different syndicates.
Well, I mean, look at the American Music Corporation, right? And Lou Wasserman and Jules Steins, and these guys were, and how they sponsored people like Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan's political, he owes it to Lou Wasserman because he was the one that worked at that deal with the Actors Guild. Screen Actors Guild. They got the waiver on production and distribution. This is the coming of television and all that. It was this sweet.
I love that line in Back to the Future. He's like, well, who's the president? And Marty turns around and says, Ronald Reagan. He goes, the actor?
I think in Back to the Future 3, Donald Trump's president. So I don't predictive programming.
Biff.
I mean, we
Biff
have
is
no-
who Kurt Angle got his bad guy promos from, I'm convinced. Oh, yeah, butthead.
Yeah.
I flew to L.A. on October 21st, the year in 2015. So I was like kind of going back to the past since I'm a day ahead in Japan.
Yeah.
And it was weird because I always wondered 30 years ago when I saw that movie, what will I be doing on that day? And will there be flying cars or whatever?
Yeah.
And I never would have guessed that on that exact day I would be flying from the future to the past. And that's what I did. That night I watched a marathon of Back to the Future stuff.
But as you were saying, again, we don't know how – I mean they really have no idea how extensive – how legit organized crime has become in a sense. It's been incorporated into the mainstream economy and whether it's Hollywood.
I've been involved into it.
Yeah.
Amina Air Force. You know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Amina Air, that's the Arkansas. That's the Clinton-Bush partnership down there working. That shows you just how absurd the right-left Republican-Democrat thing is.
That's such irrelevant.
But
it's kind of like competing drug cartels. They fight with each other a little bit, but they have the same goal. Yeah.
Well, it's Lucchese's, who's the other families up there, the five families. They work things out. There's some
Giovesi. Lepke's group.
You know, and that's when they decide that to sell the heroin to the blacks. You know, ruin their neighborhoods. You know, and that's the decisions that are taken and at that level. And that's it may not be a border.
To be fair, they wanted to phase out narcotics, and they said no, we'll keep it, but just sell it to these groups.
Yeah,
that was the compromise.
Well, I think the way crack cocaine was marketed to blacks in the 80s, it's now methamphetamine being marketed to crystal meth, rather. I mean, being marketed to like a lower, into the Rust Belt.
Well, now it's heroin.
To whites,
upper class white kids in New Jersey. That's
Well, it's pouring in from Afghanistan. We got to sell it to somebody.
Especially after 2010.
And you got to keep you got to keep the stock pumped up in Wall Street, because there's no real economic growth. How are you going to get stock value up without, you know, easy money? Or you can borrow money to buy stock back. You know, that's what they're doing now, the easy credit.
You have these waves when the organized crime and these intelligence agencies are bringing in – the Israelis brought it – were bringing in ecstasy in the 90s and early 2000s. So you had these waves of everybody was MDMA, everything, and OxyContin and prescription drugs. Like, there's always something. There's always a drug market, and it always involves the government or some other government, because if it doesn't, it would never get – to the scale of the sizes that it gets to without their cooperation. It just can't.
Well, the whole point of the drug war beginning in the Harrison-Narcotic Act 1914 is to manage it and to control it in a certain way to serve economic and also geopolitical objectives. You know, that goes back to the opium wars, really. I mean, the opium wars, they were against the drug war.
The Shah's brother was a heroin farmer from Iran, right?
Yeah.
Got caught too. Nothing happens though. The Israelis finance a lot of their black ops with narcotics trafficking too, and that gets into ISIS too. But the Zionists have full support of the U.S. media, and so it's just carte blanche to do whatever they want over there. They've routinely attacked Assad from the air. They're acting as Al Qaeda's air force. They're treating Al Nusra fighters in hospitals in Golan Heights, which is occupied territory to begin with, and nothing happens because the press, partly it's because of the Jewish influence, and a lot of it is also from the military-industrial complex. This country is pro-war no matter what, because that is the megalith umbrella corporation.
Yeah.
Lockheed Martin is at the top of that. But you see, if you look at Lockheed Martin gave the seed money to the Weekly Standard and PNAC. Now, PNAC was definitely a Zionist cabal, and these guys held positions in the Department of Defense, in the Vice President's office, and, you know, and WENAP and things like that. Richard Perle and Doug Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and Louis Leiby and David Wormser and all these PNAC people. And their media outfit that Kagan and Crystal set up, called the Weekly Standard, which peddled all the pre-war lies to Iraq, got its seed money from Lockheed Martin, which is part of the MIC. And so Lockheed Martin knows, look, if we want to get a war to sell our planes, we got to make an alliance with the Zionists, because the Zionists run foreign policy in the United States. They run the press. And, you know, with Bush the lesser, the idiot, as president, and with 9/11, which I know is skipping a big event, but with that, they could pick whoever they wanted. And the first thing they did was control the heroin output of Afghanistan to finance all the black ops, and then they've reinvaded Iraq. And they've been using those narco money profits to create things like Jandallah, al-Nusra, Afar al-Sham, the Islamic State, to tear apart the rest of the Middle East and push refugees in Europe. It's been a long-term plan from Oded Yanan and before, and they get away with it because you cannot criticize or touch Zionist influence in the United States and the U.S. media. That's why we have to make alt-media, and then we got to battle with that even because of kookvilles like Jonestown. So it is a struggle.
We're talking about false flags, and there's one that gets another one that gets overlooked a lot, although the other ones are never really highlighted by the press, but people know about them. And I ran across this in Weir's book, Against Our Better Judgment, about the plan to bomb London in 1947. Are you familiar with that?
Right, and that was dovetailing off of a bunch of letter bombings. There's this letter bomb campaign targeting Egypt mostly, but that was something you have – some context I think you have to add because of the hysteria that was causing, Unabomber-esque, with this letter bombing campaign. Very interesting too, because the anthrax notes,
yes.
I'm talking to B'nai B'rith, before 2011 – before 2001, excuse me. Of course, it would be before both, but – In 1997, he's claiming to get these anthrax. It was a hoax and blamed it on Holocaust deniers.
That's funny.
Like there's some giant group. It's like eight people or something.
Yeah, the London incident says on Tuesday, I guess it was September 9th, 1947, an American newspaper, The Argus, reported that the arrest of 16 members of a Jewish terrorist group, the Stern Gang, and a U.S. Army Air Force pilot, Reginald Gilbert, by the French police. The terrorist group was led by Ukrainian-born Rabbi Baruch Korf, chairman of the American Political Action Committee for Palestine, and his private secretary, Judith Rosenberger, a Hungarian-born U.S. citizen. All of them were accused of trying to bomb the British Foreign Office building in London in order to force London to withdraw its forces from Palestine. So it goes into that. What was going on down in Palestine in 1948. But it also included a plan. They tried to recruit this guy, Reginald Gilbert, to fly a plane over London and bomb it on a foggy day. And this character, Baruch Korf, this rabbi, he was arrested but only served like a couple months in jail for this plot. And he later years, he became a very close friend and advisor to Richard Nixon, from what I understand.
I imagine they probably had the green light from London to do that because the Stern Gang – like the Purple Gang, your Ergun, they worked hand in glove with the British and the French. I mean, that before we were alluding to the Levant affair, they operated there in 1954. Of course, there would be war in 56. They're bombing these Western targets, and the Brits want to control the Suez Canal, and they're later trying to scare the Americans, saying, oh, they're going to the arms of the Soviets and da-da-da. But it's clear they just wanted to maintain control. And Israel is sort of a buffer zone. And of course, Israel has its own interest in taking down Arab states around them. They want Egypt is, at the time, a force to be reckoned with for Israel occupying Gaza and southern Palestine. And that's in Egypt's own interest. It's not like they care about Palestinians. They want someone between themselves and the Israelis, a.k.a. British. And so one of these agents' bombs went off prematurely in his jacket, and they searched his house, and they found out it's all these Israeli Jews attacking Western targets and blaming it on Egyptians. And Pinhas Levon, the defense minister, had to resign. The trial took about 6 years, so the war had happened already before all this was flushed out. And the French and British planes bombed the Egyptians in 56 with the Israelis. And that's really the forgotten war, because they always go right from the 47 to – or 48 right to the Six-Day War of 67, and they don't talk about the war in 1956 because its origins were a false flag. But then even 67, again, they preemptively struck the Egyptians and said, oh, well, they were amassing on our border. And an intelligence ship in the area that could have proven otherwise was attacked by the Israelis in unmarked planes. So even if you thought it was an Egyptian boat, why are you attacking in unmarked planes? And, you know, Johnson didn't want to embarrass an ally and wanted the damn ship on the bottom of the ocean. Of course, he was sleeping with one of these Ergun terrorists.
And
Matilda Krim and her husband were Israeli agents, and he actually knocked on her door to inform her of the news the morning of the Six-Day War, to tell her what was going on. I mean, they had him completely by the short hairs with the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
So here's Americans getting attacked by the Israelis, first trying to blame Egypt, then they try to say, oh, we thought it was an Egyptian boat. They clearly knew it was an American ship. But they wanted to say they preemptively struck because of Egyptian aggression by building up troops on their border or something. Now, of course, this is just like a week and a half after the UN peacekeepers that Eisenhower had put in there in 57 had been removed. They were there from 57 to 67, 10 years. You know, days after they're gone, Israel attacks Egypt. And Egypt was already involved with helping Yemen fight against Saudi Arabia. They did not want to fight another war with Israel at the same time. Didn't make any sense. And they wiped out their air force while it was still on the ground. So that there's just – they lie about everything. But again,
I believe
the Johnson administration was totally in bed,
yeah,
literally in bed with Israeli terrorists.
Now, I believe there was – they also – in Israel, they ran fake air raid warnings to terrorize the public.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, yeah. I talked to a man who was there, Jeff Gates. That interview's up on YouTube. And, yeah, the sirens are going, shouldn't we go somewhere? And they're like, no.
It's scared of the public. He wrote Guilt by Association, right? That was his book about
– Yes, he did.
Yeah, that's a good
book. The newest installment is coming out on that.
So yeah, we have. Of course, we mentioned the Liberty incident, which covered up. They kill, I think, 34 American servicemen, injure 171. It's covered up. No one knows about it, or very few people know about it.
And they weren't even allowed to talk about it. They were threatened. Yeah. Don't talk about what happened. Mm-hmm. This is pre-internet, so you could do that. It's amazing.
And
there's
now,
a film, there's an OK documentary called Dead in the Water that I recommend people watch. I just wish we could get like a Hollywood level film about that event.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, not gonna happen. Hey, some wealthy Russian or somebody want to throw me some money? We'll do it.
I think you'll see another 20 Holocaust movies before you see that one. Huh? Yeah. So, well, then okay, yeah, that was crucial because right after the Six-Day War, of course, they seize all that land. I think that's when they take the Golan Heights and the Sinai Desert, right? I got it correct?
Yeah, and well, Assad's father took back about 30% of the Golan Heights during the 1973 War of Yom Kippur.
Yeah, so there's some little payback there. But of course, this coincides sort of with the takeover, I would say, of foreign policy by the neoconservatives who are migrating to the Republican Party after the McGovern campaign. You know, the McGovernites take over the Democratic Party, and so the neocons become conservative, or the Jews, the Trotskyites become conservative, and hence you have the neocons. This is the, you know, Irving Kristol crowd and all that.
Yes, the train wreck between Zionists and evangelicals.
Yeah, and this gives it sort of the protean quality of the Jewish lobby or Jewish interests, how they can sort of inveigle themselves or attach themselves to some cause and bend it towards their interests. They also took over a lot of the foundation money and grants. So the conservative movement itself, which, despite what you might say about conservatism as a political philosophy in the United States, there is a lot of – well, there's a lot of – up until the 60s, there was some – people were very critical about the Cold War agenda. And this was the mission of Wilhelm F. Buckley, you know, the CIA agent Wilhelm F. Buckley, to steer the conservative cause towards the Cold War agenda, big government. But the neoconservatives come and take over the funding. So a lot of the journals and magazines that might sponsor writers and critics of U.S. policy towards Israel are marginalized or rendered unemployed. And so you have certain magazines, you know, like First Things are started to marginalize a conservative Christian opinion, or at least to steer it in a direction that's pro-Israel. Magazines like what was the other one? Chronicles magazine, which I think if you get in the intrigues of I think some of the funding they were cheated out of by the Jewish interest. They took over I think it was the Bradley Foundation or something. I might get that wrong.
Yeah, Time Life awarded to C.D. Jackson from the Psych War Department of CIA.
Well, that's a huge that's Skull and Bones CIA WASP establishment. Yeah, the Henry Luce. That's the American Century stuff.
But it's very important because that Psych War Department was essential in creating a lot of the exaggerations about the Holocaust.
Yes, C.D. Jackson. Yes, right. Yeah.
And, well, Billy Wilder.
Billy.
Because right to Zionist Hollywood there.
Alfred Hitchcock apparently was there too. Yeah, and a lot of the, of course, they probably
Wilder
footage.
Steps into a film. So he's on, on accident. So
yeah.
And to be clear, like, we're not saying people didn't die in the Holocaust or anything. I'm just saying some of the, you know, when they piled bodies up on top of each other, the Germans didn't leave them there like that in stacks like that. These people who starved to death, and the soap and lampshades and shrunken heads and some of that theatrical nonsense that they used. The whole city of Weimar, for example, was marched in to look at Buchenwald and see this stuff. None of that was true. Like, they did not make soap out of people. They did not stuff mattresses with human hair. It's you know, post-war propaganda to justify Allied crimes, because you need something really fantastic to differentiate the Allies from the Nazi powers, because everybody killed civilians. Everybody tortured. Everybody was guilty of all these things. So aha, you know, ovens and soap and things like that. And
well, it's interesting to point out is the Holocaust narrative, the amount of information we have, and also acknowledging how much bad information we do have, how bad the information really is. It is seen through the lens of wartime propaganda, and the stories we got of the Holocaust, as now it's generally accepted, is a product of Soviet propaganda for which there is no confirmation, no evidence, no film. The films we all have are from the Western camps, which, as you mentioned, Chidi Jackson, were propaganda films.
Well, all the Western liberated camps, there aren't any claims of gas chambers.
Not anymore. There used to be.
Yeah. It used to be they tried to create one in Dachau, and then they had to admit that they faked it. And so that's that. And it's like, well, maybe it all happened on the Eastern Front, or maybe it was Soviet propaganda, but – to me, it's just, you know, babies on incubators, boy in an orange chair. There's always that, you know, face for Caucus Belli.
But I was going to say, what happened was the story of the Holocaust, the story of the Final Solution, okay, for which there is very little or no documented evidence or real evidence to the enormity of the crime. There's little evidence considering the claimed enormity of the crime. Other things occurred. People died.
Well, there clearly wasn't. I mean –
yeah, there clearly wasn't a mass
there wasn't program. A plan for a death camp, or there wouldn't be kitchens and beds and things. Like, why?
Exactly.
Obviously, it's for labor. And they killed them, and they
there's slave labor and all that. Mistreatment, poor planning, war.
And
it's
murder,
war.
But it wasn't murder, a planned death camp, because it's just common sense. Like, well, why do you have a dorm? Why do you have a bed? Why do you have a kitchen?
Yeah.
You read this forgot his name. There's a Jewish psychologist who was sent to a camp. He wrote a great book I read. But, you know, in the story, it's not really part of it, but he's talking about how
– was it Gilbert?
They wanted – maybe. I'll think of it as I'm talking. Okay. But the soup kept getting thinner and thinner, and they wanted to get the thick part of the soup. And as a psychologist, he was saying, like, talking about dreams, how when people used to dream about women and cars or whatever, they started dreaming about food. Because that's what they wanted so much and constantly thinking about. So, and he was interested in what those who survived versus who didn't, their attitude and their dreams and what they thought about that helped them get through that horror. But anyway, I'm thinking, why are they giving you soup every day? I thought it was a death camp.
Yeah.
Like, if you're feeding everyone every day, it's a prison, which is horrible, and it's a labor camp. But
yes,
at least the camp he was at. He has a name like Finkelstein or something too. Victor Finkelstein, maybe. It might be Victor.
But it doesn't make any sense what you're saying.
Yeah. But anyway, it just is clearly there were some labor camps. If there were death camps, there were definitely labor camps just because of all the survivor stories. There had to be. That had to be what that was. And they were doing labor. They were making shoes and rubber and stuff. So either both existed or one, but they weren't all death camps because – I mean, Holocaust survivors an oxymoron already.
Exactly.
it just – even as like a 7-year-old kid, I'm like, really? Why didn't they just line everyone up and machine gun them and be done in one day? Like, it's Soviet propaganda.
The source of the information is Soviet propaganda. If that's a reliable source, fine. But it's also the stories we got from the Final Solution were reports that are coming through the War Refugee Board, which were run out of the Treasury Department, which was run by Morgenthau, a Zionist, and also what was his name? The guy who established the Bretton Woods system, the Soviet spy, Harry Dexter White. Harry Dexter White. So this is the source of the information. That juxtaposed with we now know that right after the war, the Chidi Jackson through the Office of War Information, OSS, went in there and produced a bunch of propaganda films that, well, at the very least, obviously wildly exaggerated the atrocity stories and also misrepresented what was going on there, because the conditions in the camp were horribly were worsened by the war, the bombing, the destruction of the German economy, the invasion, so they couldn't provide for the people in the camps.
That's
anymore.
Why all the bodies are so skinny.
Yes, and
undoubtedly,
fat. What do you get with the war? You always get
famine,
disease, starvation. That's what you got. And you all throughout Germany was Germany itself was starving. It just in the camps you couldn't leave. You know, so it was made that much worse, and they made the most of it propaganda-wise.
Well, let me tie this together, though, with what we were saying about Kennedy, because the Zapruder film that we've seen was not shown until 7 years after his death, and that's because Chidi Jackson died. C.D. Jackson with Time Life magazine had bought the film, and they'd only released some still pictures in Time magazine of Kennedy's death.
And didn't they reverse the frames too?
They messed with all of it. His daughters, or C.D. Jackson had a bunch of daughters. That's who released the Saputo film. That's why Congress got involved in reinvestigating. You know, after the Warren Commission and all that, Congress investigated again and determined their belief that there were at least two shooters. But I just wanted to point that out, that Time magazine had bought the film. So they're like, I mean, come on, his brain's going out the back of his head. He must have been shot in the front. It was duh. But they didn't see that film for 7 years. And you know who never got to see it was Bobby Kennedy, because he was killed in 68. June 5th, 1968. So he never got to see the Saputo film because, boy, he definitely, if with that evidence, what we've all seen and think is so clear, people did not see right after Kennedy was killed.
No, yeah.
And when it was finally shown, there was an investigation and they did determine a conspiracy.
Yeah.
That was that. And a lot of people don't know that our own House Select Committee on Assassinations determined multiple shooters based on audio evidence. But they weren't pushing real hard to figure out who that was. I figured out who it was. It wasn't easy.
Yeah, I think the House subcommittee concluded a probable conspiracy, but they didn't endorse a new investigation for some reason.
Because
doesn't matter, I guess.
A lot of them were still involved in government.
Mm-hmm. And you also hit a string of deaths around that time too, right? So that's when Giancana gets shot, I think, and Johnny Roselli turns up chopped up in Miami Bay or something.
Cops got killed too. Roger Craig was murdered. He'd already been run off the road and was virtually handicapped, and then he was murdered in his house. I mean, policeman of the year, though.
Mm-hmm.
Officer Tippett from day one, because Tippett's death is, in my mind, important in unraveling this mystery too. And he had breakfast with Oswald that morning, same diner.
Well, that's when the Oswald runs into the movie theater.
I actually know what they ate. Like, that's when I know I'm too deep into something. They're like, I know that Omar Mamari had a ham sandwich at around 12 afternoon on 9/11, you know, and I know what Tippett had for breakfast. So that's when I'm like, okay, I got to get back away from this stuff for a couple weeks or something. But
well, if we live in,
I love it. It's been kind of not fun, but I don't know. It's been intriguing to investigate the Kennedy assassination. I went to L.A. and talked to James DeAngelo. I Skyped with Michael Collins Piper. I've read so many books about it, and I've just had the advantage of growing up with the internet, because all these guys did all the hard work, writing books and
going to libraries.
Going to libraries and
flying
remember
around
these things.
Yeah, you have to fly around the presidential library.
Drive to another city and talk to someone and that kind of stuff. And I've just been someone lucky enough to have an interest in this subject because of my 9/11 work, and then just kept going backward in time and unraveling other stuff. And then, boom, here's the big one. And I've gotten to talk to all these people, and they're older, and everybody has a piece of the puzzle. But there's never been, like, that I know of, some forum for them to get together and compare notes. And unfortunately, a lot of the Kennedy factions have, like camps, like kind of groups.
Yeah.
I don't care who's right about what. I'm just gathering info and hopefully can put it out in a film here as soon as I can pay for it.
Yep. Well, that's where they pinch you, the finances. You don't get any funders, so
it could happen, though. I'm about halfway there, and yeah. I'm asking people on Patreon, look, if you can donate $1 a month, it's not only the Kennedy films. It's the film I was mentioning about the Native American story where the BIA blew up a house, and there's a lot of little projects I want to do, and Kennedy's a big one, and we're at the halfway mark, and this could be done in a day. I have like 27,000 YouTube followers. I mean, a dollar is not going to hurt you. I'm talking about a month. Like,
yeah,
you could not have a coffee for one single day, like even one third of a coffee nowadays.
Yeah, exactly.
But and give me that dollar. Collectively, I would end up with $2,000 or $3,000, even if just a small percentage. I need it for 27,000. That would be great to have $27,000 a month. That would be awesome. But
no, yeah.
We'd have our own Hollywood stuff then. But if people could just think about it, you can always stop too. Like, you could do it one time. But if they can get on Patreon and consider giving $1 or $2 if they're a high roller, it's a really big deal. Like, it lets me continue this business and research and talk to guys like you and Doug Valentine and other and all the people on my podcast, but specifically about the Kennedy assassination. Before they leave, Michael Pons Piper's gone. He died a year and a half ago. Right, the days before an interview about RFK that we were going to do and really spill the beans. It's really sad, but
yeah.
I'm glad I got to pick his brain before he passed away. And a lot of these people are older, and man, I want to gather it. And so I'm encouraging people to send me your shekels, $1 a month, $2 a month, because it really makes a big difference. It helps with these films, it helps with the production value too, not just the research and the time and everything else. And I'd love to have like my own media company. I'd hire you in a second. Like, I want to have good researchers.
Oh yeah, the resources and all that stuff. But it can be leveraged so effectively too.
We can do it now though because of the internet, because of crowdfunding.
Yeah,
I mean, if Ken O'Keefe can con people out of $100,000 so he can go on vacation in Dominica and stuff, like, if you were to give that fraction of that money to people who really care,
I heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sad, man. Like, you want to have someone that's a champion for Palestine or something, but they put up like three walls of a school or something, and then he went to Hawaii. Now he's in Dominica farting around. Like, don't give money to con artists. You know, every time I've taken a trip or made a film, I made Decades of Deception and The Empire Mask. I go to these conferences in D.C. I started a mini conference in L.A. a couple months ago. Hopefully next year it'll be bigger. Like, I always do what I say I'm going to do. And we can beat them, but like, it doesn't cost much to tell the truth. It costs a lot more to lie. You have to have constant propaganda and lies daily to maintain deception. The truth doesn't need all that, but it's not free either. So we, you know, if we could get those donations to Patreon, it would really help. And I'd love to get some guys together, yourself, Joaquin Flores, some people. I got a team in mind. Who I'd like to pay if we could get the funding.
Well, I mean, really, what it is you also got to convince people to turn off the
turn off the television.
Turn off the television. That's the big psychological warfare weapon right there. I mean, that's just
it is. And that's
I can within a few minutes I can tell if I'm talking to someone who watches too much television or they get their information from the television.
You know, they have the same catchphrases. Yeah. Like, you'll be talking to people and they'll say something to you that was said on the news. You know,
yeah,
and it's not even their own thought. And I'm not sure if they're aware or not that they didn't even come up with that. It was something like too big to fail, for example. They go, you know what, we had to do something. They're too big to fail. And you just heard that on Fox or CNBC or something.
Yeah. Or remember when Hillary passed out, everyone using power, she's powering through? There's a YouTube thing where they do – everyone's – all the stations, she's powered through like a working woman. Like, women always do, they power through. So it turns.
Well, nobody else passed out at that conference. She's the only one. So
she's powering through. You know, she's a working mother, or, you know, working grandmother.
That's what happens when you're on gear. She's on so many drugs.
I know. And this is how they take a situation where, like, the average American woman has been forced out in the workplace because she can't keep up with the debt and the inflation that the system creates. So she has to have 2-3 jobs. And so this is heroic as opposed to sad that families are rendered or reduced to the situation.
Yeah, even if it happened to a guy, it's still sad.
It's sad. But we like George Bush at the debate where a woman says, "I have 3 jobs," and he goes, "That's uniquely American."
Yeah. Well, Clinton was saying, "I got stamina. Wait till you go to this many countries and broker a peace deal." I'm like, you know, that peace deal was broken within hours. The Israelis bombed.
Yeah.
The Syrians, and then the Americans accidentally bombed the Syrians trying to bomb ISIS. No one believes that. I guarantee you Putin's like, really? You accidentally bombed the Syrian army the moment we had a temporary no-fly zone?
Yeah,
so we're not going to do any bombings? Why? If we're not supposed to be bombing targets, why are you bombing any targets, even if you thought it was ISIS? The deal was no planes. And the Israelis and Americans go there and bomb the Syrians exclusively, and Al-Qaeda is right behind them. Like, the air campaign came in, and then the ground troops went in. They're coordinated. It's obvious.
But no one cares.
I mean, people are just denial.
Yeah, there's no consequences for that, though. No one's going to go to jail, lose their job, must just lose their job, or have them explain themselves.
You end up getting voted president.
Yes. You know, you bomb people.
She can still lose the Electoral College. It's sad to put my hopes in Donald Trump, but I feel like that guy at least He does want to renegotiate trade deals for his own ego and legacy, but whatever. If his ego overlaps with U.S. interests, I'll just take that as a win.
Yeah.
And, you know,
if he can says if he says let's work with Russia, maybe perhaps there's a faction within the elite that are saying, you know, this neocon faction is insane. So this is why Donald Trump's campaign is allowed to progress so far, because there's got to be people within this group saying that, you know, poking the bear this long is just stupid. It's counterproductive. We have to draw
all
back.
The neocons are supporting Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Like all the – I mean, George Bush Sr. is supporting Clinton. Like this, all the neocons are supporting Clinton and hate Donald Trump.
Which reveals the true nature of the system itself.
Because Trump wants to work with Assad and kill ISIS.
Yeah.
And that's not what Israel wants. That's not why they're there.
Because ISIS, whether Trump knows it or not, ISIS is a proxy force of the Anglo-American Zionist Empire.
Yes, it is.
You know?
That's what it is, Anglo-American Zionist Empire.
Yeah. And that's what they are. And that's what people don't get when they're talking about ISIS. We're ISIS. ISIS is ISIS. This is. We're supporting – not we. NATO, the Western governments, Turkey, all this. Turkey's NATO, and they're operating out of Turkey. I mean, it's obvious.
And well, they were. They lost that peg.
Yeah.
Russia successfully
– Well, that's yeah, – then we're condemning Russia. And all of a sudden, everyone's concerned about Russia bombing civilians. The U.S. empire is worried about civilians getting hurt. Whatever happened to collateral damage, right? Why can't Putin just call it collateral damage if it's occurring at all?
Fallujah. I mean, how can they point the finger? They dropped Agent Orange all over Vietnam. They nuked Japan twice. It's so audacious. I can't believe it. But you and I could talk about Zionism for 10 more hours and not be. I know we only got up to like the 50s with false flags, but it's a like
well, your video,
a little bit half hour after midnight here, so yeah, I gotta go soon.
Yeah,
but
I'll let you go. But the obviously, if people want to look into some of the details of the false flags, I encourage people to watch the Empire en Masse. That's a very detailed examination of the the Zionist angle of 9/11, among other things as well.
The undercovered angles, yeah,
yeah.
Also, decades of deception.
Yes,
that's plural. That on decades of deception and war. I think I retitled it just to make it different from that moron's movie. That's free. It's only 58 minutes. And I like that one. It's a nice, concise, like, timeline of the CIA doing horrible things around the world.
Yeah. And it puts things in perspective, in context. That's what we need, a proper context of these events to understand them and to understand whether it's the First World War, Second World War, the Cold War,
Civil War,
so-called, and the, you know, war on terror, these things that
war on drugs.
Well, it's all a lie, all a con. War's a racket, whether it's a cold war, war on drugs, or a world war. Yeah.
War is the health of this parasite. I changed it.
Well, listen, Ryan.
Because parasite and state are synonyms, so.
Yeah. You reminded me that it is late. I forget. It's here. It's early in the morning, or not. It's mid-morning, and there it's – in Japan, it's you're getting into the next day. So I'm going to let you go.
But thank you very much, and we'll talk neocolonialism. And after we can both get and read Doug's books, maybe we should have a roundtable on that topic as well.
Yeah, I'm anxious, waiting for that to come out, because that's great. That's a whole nother read Doug Valentine, man. Read his work, and you'll give another dimension.
Some of the best stuff on the mafia,
yes.
Of the best.
So,
strength of the wolf, strength of the pack.
Great. Listen, Ryan, thanks. I'll let you go get some sleep. And we'll talk again soon. Yeah, neocolonialism, that's the next topic. Maybe we'll shortly.
Yeah, we'll do that. I'll do it, man, in a month or so, maybe.
Yeah, that's a good time. Yeah, talk about, explain what's going on in Africa and around the world, how it's a business model.
Yeah, I like that. I think it'd be a good show.
So great. Okay, I'll let you go. Thanks a lot. And I'll be posting this soon. When I do, I will send you the link.
All right, thank you very much.
Take it easy. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.